really beyond hope that exists entirely out of our hands. This means something to me, Marisol, Luis says, echoing his earlier words in the hotel elevator. A little crack forms over my heart. This means something to me, too. I spend the rest of the drive back to Havana with Luis's arm wrapped around my shoulders, his lips occasionally brushing my temple, our legs pressed against each other, studying his profile. Let's go out tonight, he suggests as we near the city. Let's do something to take your mind off all of this.
Like a date?
He laughs. Yes, a proper date. Somewhere along the way we've gotten things turned around a bit. I'll pick you up and take you to dinner. Nothing fancy, but I promise the food will be perfection. He winks at me. I happen to know a few good paladeres. Afterward we can go dancing. I grin. You dance? Somehow I can't imagine formal, slightly serious Luis dancing. Then again, occasionally, he says with a small smile. Don't tell anyone, but my grandmother taught me when I was a very little boy.
Mine too. She used to play old records in her living room and we'd dance together.
I was terrible at first, I confess. And now? He teases.
I have a few moves.
I'm even more intrigued. I need to help my grandmother get ready for the dinner service since I missed yesterday. But perhaps we can go out afterward?
I would love that.
When we arrive back at the house, we part ways, and I set my bag down in my bedroom and head to the heart of the house, the kitchen, where Ana is preparing dinner for the Paladad's guests. She smiles when she sees me. How was your trip? She asks, greeting me with a kiss on the cheek.
Beautiful, I answer.
I'm not ready to tell her what we learned from Magda. I'm still processing the news myself.
Can I help you prepare dinner?
Ana waves me off with a cluck of her tongue.
No, no, I have it. It's almost done. We have paella today.
I can smell it. The aroma of yellow rice and seafood filling the tiny space. She has the same style of enormous pan my grandmother used to cook her paella sitting on top of the stove.
How do you decide the menu each day? I ask.
It depends on what I can get at the market. If I can find chicken that day. We eat arroz con pollo. If they have seafood, I make a paella. We're limited by the shortages, of course, but we make do.
That has to be challenging.
She smiles. I like a bit of a challenge. It helps me to be creative with the menu, and it keeps the guests happy because there's always variety. It's not an easy business. When the government opened the paladar system, many tried and many failed. The taxes and license fees can bankrupt you. Not to mention, you can create a menu only to have it fail miserably when you can't find the ingredients. You can spend days searching for something as simple as eggs or milk. Many of our guests, the tourists who come, don't understand the challenges we face. They judge our restaurants by the standards they are used to in their home countries. But we make do with Cuban ingenuity. She winks at me. It doesn't hurt that we have Luis playing La Bella Mesa on the saxophone. We hang the photos my husband took in the revolution's early days on the wall, serve our guests on what's left of my grandmother's finest china. They come here for the romantic Cuban experience, and we give it to them. Was that what I had come here for? The romantic Cuban experience? I'd be lying if I didn't admit I'd had an image in my mind of what it would be like here. I told myself I'd be open-minded, that I wouldn't let the stories I'd heard, my family's perspective of exile, cloud my impressions of the real Cuba. I'd been convinced I'd find two narratives here, ours and theirs, and that the truth would lie somewhere in between, but I didn't realize how bad it would be. In all the discussions of opening relations with Cuba, of eradicating the embargo, the focus has always been on the island as a tourist paradise, perpetually frozen in time. I didn't realize how much people still suffered, didn't understand the depth and breadth of the problems facing everyday Cubans. Ana gives me a sidelong glance. Speaking of Luis,
Her voice trails off for a moment. Elisa and I used to talk about our lives when we grew older. We imagined being bridesmaids in each other's weddings, raising our children together, becoming grandmothers together. We used to imagine our children playing as best friends, perhaps even falling in love. It's good to see the two of you together. We're not... I'm not even sure how to finish the sentence. Not together?
Not in love?
I don't know how we can be together, I say instead. Have faith, Marisol. You could be good for each other. It might seem impossible now, but trust me. You never know what the future can bring. Luis walks into the kitchen at the tail end of her speech, greeting his grandmother with a hug and kiss. I busy myself with a paella, mindlessly stirring to occupy my hands, my cheeks burning. There are some things we've yet to speak of, conversations I'm not ready to have. I leave soon. What will happen when I do? Will we keep in touch, or will this connection between us peter out once we return to our normal lives? Anna leaves to visit the guests, and we're alone once again. Luis closes the distance between us, kissing my forehead. He smiles at me as I pause mid-stir. His fingers stroke my nape. I flush again. You're nervous, he says, sounding amused by the notion. Yes.
Why? You weren't nervous before.
I was always a bit nervous, but it feels strange in this house. With your grandmother here, Cristina, your mother. I don't want to step on anyone's toes. And then there's everything else. I don't want to start something I can't finish. I don't know what I'm doing here, I confess. I came to bury my grandmother, and now everything is mixed up. I have a grandfather I never knew I had, and you. I came here to write an article about tourist locales, and now my mind is full of policy and injustice. I came here single and carefree, and now I risk leaving my heart behind. It's as though Cuba has awoken something in me, and I can't, don't want to, shut it off. I know. Luis steps back with a sigh. Things are complicated. Yes. I turn, looking into his dark eyes, searching. You're good at that, I murmur.
Good at what?
Hiding what you're feeling. Thinking? About some things you're an open book, but with others. My voice trails off. You're difficult to read. Is it really a mystery, Marisol? I close my eyes at the sound of my name falling from his lips, as my pulse accelerates at the flutter in my stomach. When I open my eyes, he's still there, his gaze boring into me, his expression as inscrutable as ever. Luis steps forward, closing the distance between us, his lips caressing my forehead, his fingers running through my hair. He takes a step back and gestures toward the stove. Dinner is almost finished. Can you be ready in an hour? I open my mouth to answer him. Luis's mom, Caridad, walks into the kitchen, setting a stack of plates down on the tiny counter space with a thud. Luis's hands drop to his side. My cheeks flame as I take a deep breath, the air whooshing through my lungs. Do you want to leave in an hour or so? He asks again, his voice low. I nod. Caridad's gaze follows me from the room.
Chapter 23 Elisa. He died in Santa Clara. He fought valiantly. There's little else I have to remember him by besides the memories I cling to now, the letters, and the few tangible signs I have that he was real, and that he loved me. And then there's the baby. I spend 2 days in bed. My sisters cover for me. They don't ask any questions, but their worry is a palpable thing. Only Magda knows the truth. Only Magda knows the full extent of my fears, and my heartache. She sits beside my bed, stroking my hair, attempting to convince me to eat and drink. For the baby, she whispers. I exist in shadows, the sunlight flitting and disappearing, the noise of the household around me, the sounds of the street I've come to loathe. Several days after my world is ripped apart, I'm forced out of bed. We have a new crisis to contend with. Revolutions don't care much for broken hearts and shattered dreams. They finally reached my father's name on the list. My mother is sobbing on the couch when I come downstairs, Isabel and Beatriz sitting beside her. Maria is in her room with Magda. It's becoming more and more difficult to shield her from all of this. What happened? I ask. I always feared it would be Alejandro who drew their notice. Alejandro, who wasn't afraid to denounce Fidel, who danced far too close to the flames. But our father... Beatriz answers me. Che went by his offices. Oh, how I hate the Argentinian. It's bad enough to see Fidel behaving as though the country is his for the taking. But Che isn't even Cuban, adding insult to injury. He took him to La Cabaña, Isabel says, her expression grim. Batista's prison has been converted to Fidel's prison. Some revolution. When? This morning, Beatriz answers, her face pale. That's all we know. Under the new freedom and democracy Fidel is bringing to Cuba, they can hold him for however long they like, do whatever they'd like to him. Progress. I fear the anger inside me will simply erupt one day, no longer contained by silk gowns and gloves. They will kill him, my mother whispers. They won't, Isabel says, her words lacking conviction. They might kill him. A tear trickles down my cheek, then another, piercing the haze that surrounds me. My grief over Pablo's death is suddenly a luxury I cannot afford. What will we do? My mother asks. Leave Cuba. The thought surprises me, but there's logic behind it. The image of the crowd knocking over the parking meters, looting, filling my mind once more. This is no longer a safe place for us. And if they are after our father, how long before they come after all of us? How safe will my child, all that I have left of Pablo, be in this version of Havana? Where is Alejandro? We wait, Beatriz says instead, her voice grim. Time moves differently now that Batista is no longer in power. I used to complain that my days were filled with parties and monotony. Now they're filled with terror, and I long for the days when my biggest worry was which hat suited me best. Our father remains in La Cabaña, and each day brings more executions and no word from Alejandro. More and more of my parents' friends are leaving the country, heading to the United States, to Europe. More and more people leave, yet we wait, waiting to hear what will come of our father, waiting for a message from our brother, waiting, waiting, always waiting. Our mother's uncle visits our father, passing on the news that he is still alive, confined to a dank, dark prison cell. Isabel and Beatriz sit next to our mother, holding her hand while our great-uncle delivers an update on our father's condition, with a grim expression on his face. Days pass, a week, until waiting at home becomes as distasteful as the alternative, and we find ourselves in the belly of the beast. The prison was built as a fortress in the 18th century to guard against English pirates, and later converted to a military barracks. It is being run by the Argentinian, Che Guevara, the very man Pablo once spoke of to me. His friend, his brother in arms. The stone fortress looms in front of us, Beatriz's hand clutched in mine. This is a bad idea, I whisper, my hand drifting to my stomach. I catch myself mid-motion, allowing my arm to dangle at my side. The nausea is back in full force, this morning's breakfast already reappearing. The sun beats down on us, unrelenting. Would you rather have stayed in the house? She asks. No, but it isn't only me anymore. I should have refused when Beatriz asked me to accompany her. She squares her shoulders, her gaze on the looming stone fortress, a familiar expression on her face. Beatriz on a mission is a dangerous thing. Wait for me here. Are you crazy? I hiss. You can't go in there on your own. What would you suggest I do? They're killing people, Beatrice, with frightening regularity. Anger blazes in her eyes. Beatrice's rage just might be a dangerous thing, too. There's someone who might help me, she says. If Beatrice has connections in La Cabaña, I grab her arm, pulling her toward me. Are you involved with the 26th of July? Of course not. The words drip with contempt. But I know someone who is. A friend? My voice lowers. A lover? Not even close. Her gaze returns to the stone fortress, as though she's steeling herself for an unpleasant task. A shiver slides down my spine at the ferocity in her expression. There will be no dissuading her. It's been days, nearly a week. Who knows where Alejandro is? Her voice breaks. Who knows if he's even alive? And our father? What else are we to do? I have to try. Beatrice, please. I let her go because there is no other option. If I don't let her go in today, she'll just come back and try again tomorrow. Reason has fled all of us, and yet I no longer have the luxury of making reckless decisions myself. My baby has already lost one parent to this revolution. It's up to me alone to keep our child safe. I stand in the shadow of La Cabaña, watching as my brave, beautiful, headstrong sister walks into the fortress. I almost envy Beatrice. Her independence, her courage, her audacity. For the first time, the full impact of my pregnancy hits me. I was so focused on Fidel, and then Pablo's death, and now my father's imprisonment, that the baby has been an abstract concept. But I am to be a mother now, to raise this child on my own. It is both a terrifying responsibility and a tremendous joy. Soldiers pass by me, their green fatigues ragged, their gazes first on me, then drifting to Beatrice's retreating figure. Their laughter echoes in the air. The nausea makes another untimely appearance. I pray. Words from childhood. Words I've used more in the past several months than in the totality of my life combined. I pray for Beatrice, for my father, for my brother, for my unborn child. For all of us now. Minutes pass. An hour. The stark reality that I may have lost Beatrice, too, that our father might never be returned to us, hits me with an intensity that grows with each ticking moment. How are we to provide for our family without him? Will my great-uncle take us in? Another distant family member? How will we survive this? And just when my panic reaches an unbearable level, Beatrice walks out. It's impossible to tell if she was successful or not. Beatrice walks the same in victory and defeat. She stops a foot away from me, her expression grim. I wasn't able to get him out. I was able to see him, though. He's injured, but fine. Furious with me for coming. She swallows. They shoved him in a cell with 10 other men, like animals. What are they going to do with him? I don't know. Her silence tells a different tale. Beatrice, they're shooting people. 3 times a day, like clockwork. Her expression turns murderous. Che likes his schedules. This time I do throw up, the contents of my breakfast landing on the ground beneath me. Beatrice is there in an instant, silent, stroking my back, pulling my hair away from my face. What's going on with you? She asks, her gaze sharp once I've righted myself. I shake my head, wiping at my lips with the handkerchief I pull out of my bag, an acrid taste in my mouth. It isn't the time. Soon it will be, though. How much longer can I hide this secret? How much weight can we bear on our shoulders before we collapse? Beatrice seems to accept my answer for the moment, but her gaze is searching. The corner of her mouth is smudged. Bright red lipstick marring her face. I shudder. What happened in there? She shakes her head, her gaze shuddered. I'm fine. It isn't the time, she says. I wrap my arms around her, needing this moment of comfort. What do we do now? I ask her. We go home, and we wait. We lock arms, turning away from the fortress. My legs shake. Behind us, the sound of gunshots fill the air. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I count them as tears rain down my cheeks. For the first time in my life, I know what it is to truly hate, the emotion filling me entirely, annihilating everything else in its path. And then the hate is gone, as swiftly as it came, leaving me with new emotions I'm not equipped to deal with. There are dozens of ways you can betray your country. Broken promises, failed policies, the sound of a firing squad pumping bullets into flesh. And then there's the silent betrayal, the most insidious one of all. We thought we were being smart by merely enduring Batista. We thought we were playing the long game, cozying up to power so we could keep our grand homes and our yacht club memberships and our champagne-filled parties. We thought the indignities of his regime wouldn't touch us. I told myself being a Pérez meant more than being Cuban, that my responsibility to my family, to do what was expected, to be the woman my parents wanted me to be, meant more than fighting for what I believed in, for speaking out against Batista's tyranny. And the whole time we were pretending our way of life was fine, the paradise we'd created was really a fragile deal with a mercurial devil. And the ground beneath us shifted and cracked, destroying the world as we knew it. Fidel has shown us the cost of our silence, the danger of waiting too long to speak, of another's voice being louder than ours, because we were too busy living in the bubbles we'd created to realize the rest of Cuba had changed and left us behind. I feel guilt and shame.
Chapter 24 Marisol. That night I dressed for dinner with Luis, counting down the few days, 3, we have left together in my mind, wanting this evening to be special, to make the most of our time together. Luis knocks on my door just as I'm finished changing into my red dress, the scent of the perfume I've spritzed lingering in the air. I open the door and am greeted by the sight of Luis standing outside my room, smiling at me, his gaze running over my appearance, a bouquet of sunflowers in his hand. We walk from the Rodriguez house to the Malecón, our hands joined, fingers linked. When we reach the water's edge, he buys 2 bottles of Presidente from a cart vendor. We take a seat on the stone ledge, our feet dangling over the water as it crashes against the rock, the sea spray hitting my bare calves. The sunset rolls in, transforming the landscape as the locals come out of the crumbling buildings, lining the promenade, carrying music and laughter with them. Luis hooks an arm around my shoulders, bringing me closer to his body, my head burrowed in the crook of his neck. My lips slide over the skin there, tasting the salt from the water. My hair whips around me in the wind. I'm going to miss this, I say, turning away from him and staring out at the sea. It feels like I just got here, and now there's not much time left. I've been thrust into this unexpected world, its impression lingering. I no longer wish to write about Cuban restaurants and foods. I long to write about revolutions, exile, loss. I ache to write about Cuba's future. I yearn to return. How can I return to Miami and resume the life I lived before, now that everything has changed? Luis's grip on me tightens, a sharp exhale escaping his mouth. He doesn't answer me. What is there to say? I hope I can return soon. Hope relations will continue to improve. Pray the barriers between our countries will lessen with time. Who knows? We're just a small country in a world full of tragedies. I want a chance to learn about my grandfather, to see Ana again, to explore the parts of the island I've yet to see. And of course, there's Luis. He tips my head toward him, capturing my mouth in a fierce kiss. My hand rests over his heart, my fingers gripping the fabric of his shirt.
I've been with enough men, am old enough to recognize that this thing between us is different than any time before, that my heart is engaged in a way it never has been. I've never felt this instant connection with someone, this sense of recognition, the audible click of two pieces fitting together. Behind us, someone laughs and cheers, the sound filtering to background noise. My world narrowed to this. I love you. The words seem unfair, a burden to place on him, a tether with far too many commitments attached. Our lives couldn't be more different, and I struggle to imagine him inhabiting my world, as much as it's impossible to envision myself living here. The part of me that yearns to feel a connection to this place wishes I could ignore the realization that this is not my home. It's the land of my grandmother, the legacy that shapes me. But the modern iteration is something else entirely. Something I can't quite identify with, no matter how badly I wish it were so. My family's fortunes have changed. And while this is our past, and hopefully our future, it cannot be our present. And yet, this is where my grandmother wished to rest. The country that held such a fierce hold over her heart. Was it the country or the man? Or did the memory of both become so inextricably linked, tangled up in each other, that it became impossible for her to tell where one ended and the other began? She fell in love with him here, on the Malecón. The words they whispered carried on the air, their eyes cast toward the sea.
"What are you thinking about?"
Luis asks. "My grandmother, her life here.
You don't have much time left to decide where to spread her ashes."
"I know." I look out at the water, the sun making its final descent. I can't help but wonder what would have happened if he never died. If they had had a chance at a life together. Would the revolution have kept them apart, or would they have loved each other enough to make it work? Luis brings our joined hands to his lips.
"I don't know."
"Neither do I." We walk into Vedado, down darkened streets, the tourists ensconced in their hotels, the locals out in full swing. Without the kitschy-themed bars and the state-run restaurants in the more touristy parts of the city, Cubans make their own fun, impromptu dance parties breaking out on the sidewalk, kids gathered in circles, playing games, their laughter ringing in the night. Luis grins at me, my hand in his.
"Now you're getting the authentic Cuban experience."
"Where are we going?" He's vacillated between playful and serious all evening, and these moments when he's happy and teasing are my absolute favorite.
"You'll see,"
he answers with a wink. A car turns down the street, bathing me in the glow of two bright headlights. It stops. Luis brings me to his side, putting his body between the vehicle and me. It's not a vintage car like the ones I'm used to seeing in Havana now. Chrome, leather, bright colors, and rolling lines. This one is black, boxy, ugly, old in a way that's neither glamorous nor nostalgic. Luis's hand on my waist tenses. It drops away. Two men step out of the car. They're dressed casually, nondescript clothes that wouldn't draw my attention under normal circumstances. They walk as though they are in uniform, though, with the kind of purpose that comes with the sanction of official power. They might not approach us flashing badges, but it makes no difference. They are important. They are powerful. Even though he is in the grave, there is no mistaking it. They are Fidel's. It happens so quickly. The flash of headlights, the sound of heavy metal car doors opening, slamming shut, the footfall of shoes on the cracked sidewalk. Luis's voice saying my name, the warning contained there, a scream wrapped in a whisper. "Marisol." He steps away from me, leaving me standing on the sidewalk alone, my hand dangling at my side. It's only a few steps, but he might as well have shoved me away from him. We were together, and now we're not. I am Cuban, and I am not. Luis's back is to me, but tension is evident in the set of his shoulders, in the distance between us.
The perimeter surrounding him and the men walking toward him might as well be contained by an electrified fence. No one on the street pays us any attention. Their gaze is anywhere but on Luis and the men. On me. Their gaits growing more rapid. Their feet carrying them far away from the danger surrounding them. The effort they exert not looking toward us is a palpable thing. The men stop in front of Luis. Their voices are low, and I can only make out bits and pieces of the conversation, but it's enough. They're taking him with them. I don't know where. Luis doesn't look back at me as he gets in the car. Doesn't turn around and beseech me to tell his grandmother and mother where he's gone. Doesn't ask for me to call an attorney on his behalf. He doesn't protest or attempt to fight them off, as though he's resigned himself to the inevitability of this. The car drives away in a squeal of tires, and he's gone, the dark vehicle making its way down the Havana street, leaving me behind, wondering when, if, he'll return. My heart pounds, the passport in my purse burning a hole there. Should I go to the American embassy? Or return to the Rodriguez home and let Ana and Caridad know what has happened? Minutes earlier, I felt safe, happy here in Havana with Luis. Now I'm terrified. The streets in Vedado no longer look so friendly. The evening growing dark, and I doubt I could find my way back to Miramar without assistance. Should I hail a cab? Check into a hotel and ask for help? Another car pulls up alongside me. I grip my bag, holding it to my body, trying to remember the lessons I learned in the self-defense class my grandmother made me take nearly a decade ago. A single girl living alone in Miami can never be too careful, Marisol. A man with a thick neck and hulking shoulders gets out of the car. He looks like the sort of man women take note of in parking garages, on elevators, the sort of man you instinctively fear. For a moment, I freeze, my brain attempting to reconcile the fact that he's walking toward me. He reaches out, his hand gripping my arm, pulling me toward the car, and I explode. My arms and legs hitting him, a scream torn from the depths of my throat. Will anyone help me? And then there are more hands on me, and they lift me, limbs flailing, and dump me in the back seat of the car.
Chapter 25 Elisa. As quickly as they grabbed him, the regime returns our father to us, battered and bloody but alive. We exist in a state of nervous détente. No one knows why Fidel chose to toss him back like a fish too small to be gobbled up by the regime. But we're on tenterhooks, waiting to see if they will come for him again. Perhaps Fidel's too busy, his attention on bigger things. We've gone from private firing squads under Batista to public trials and executions courtesy of Fidel. I can just summon up the bare minimum amount of rage. The smallest dollop of horror. I'm numb on the inside. It's been 2 weeks since Guillermo came to our door and told me Pablo had died, and it still feels like I'm living a nightmare. At night, I read Pablo's letters over and over again, as though they could conjure him up, the words on the page transforming into flesh and blood man. No one warned me love would hurt so much. We gather in front of the television, in a routine that is now becoming all too familiar. Indeed, this is a family affair. Even my mother is here watching. As much as the whole process repels her, the very idea of the masses judging the elite is anathema to her. There's a morbid curiosity that drives us all. Is this what they felt in France as they watched the guillotine's blade be judge, jury, and executioner? All it takes these days is an accusation, even the word of a child, to commit a man to death. Fidel says these spectacles will bring transparency, that he has nothing to hide, and he isn't wrong. The horror of what has befallen our country is indeed on display for the world to see. When will someone come to our aid? When will the rest of the world condemn him? In the end, it's too much to watch. The television's harsh glare doing nothing to dull the travesty before us. We sit slack-jawed and appalled. Unable to speak, unable to move. How many of our countrymen have died since Fidel took power? 1,000? 2? Their names are whispered, and then forgotten, left to linger in the air before they disappear forever. Finally, it's Beatrice who breaks the spell. "Turn off the TV," she snaps at Maria. She should not be seeing this. What are my parents thinking? We should all be working to preserve the fiction of her innocence, to protect her from all of this. They should be protecting her. But ever since Fidel marched into Havana, ever since Batista left and everything changed, my parents have devolved into a state of inaction. Maria's eyes widen at Beatrice's tone. She's enjoyed a sanctuary of sorts as the youngest. We've all tried our best to be patient with her, gentle with her. But these are challenging times. I turn my gaze toward the flickering light on the TV, before it goes dark completely. They're trying Batista supporters, those who served in the military, as war criminals in the Havana sports stadium. Tens of thousands sit in the crowd cheering and jeering, eating ice cream and peanuts, roaring as they call for blood. We are Rome, and this is the Colosseum. The lion's teeth sinking into Cuban flesh for vengeance and blood sport, televised for the entire nation to watch. A cautionary tale of sorts. Will I see my father's face on TV next? My brother's? I've already lost the man I love to this madness. When does it end? This is not a trial. This is not justice. And I think of Pablo now, of what he fought and died for. The man I knew, the man I loved, would not have wanted to see us reduced to this. Where is the constitution we were promised? The end to Batista's cruelty? We have replaced one dictator with another, and still my countrymen cheer. They chant, "To the wall now," quite literally calling for the deaths of those who supported Batista, those they believe have slighted them, those they wish to stand before a firing squad. At night, when I dream, it is a strange mix that assails me. Pablo's blood-soaked hands, Fidel's roguish smile, maniacal white doves heralding disaster, crowds chanting, calling for our heads, setting Havana ablaze. Magda says it's the baby causing the dreams, that it's normal for my emotions to run high. She burns candles and offers prayers to the gods. But neither Chang'o nor Jesus appear concerned with saving Havana. The events at the stadium affect the tenor in the city, as the weeks drag on and January becomes February. My parents have snapped out of the fog that surrounded them, and they speak in hushed voices late at night, long after they think my sisters and I have gone to sleep. The household dynamics have shifted. There's an undercurrent now, as though the staff is holding its collective breath, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Magda senses it too, mediating the tension between the family and the staff, taking care of all of us. She prepares a bath for me, filling the water with herbs and perfumes, a dash of holy water smuggled out of the Cathedral of Havana. "It will protect you," she says, as I sink into the water. The clock is running down on my ability to keep the pregnancy a secret. My clothes still fit, but it's only a matter of time, and I can't help but think that if we lived in different times, if the world as we know it wasn't falling down around us, my parents would have noticed that something is wrong by now. It's perhaps the only favor Fidel has done or ever will do for me. I never knew it was possible to hate someone as much as I hate him. Every glimpse of him is a slap in the face. Why couldn't he have died instead of Pablo? Tears run down my cheeks, spilling into the bathwater, mixing with the holy water, the items the santero suggested Magda use. "Shh!" She strokes my hair, singing to me in her soothing, deep voice. And I'm at once a little girl again, safe in her embrace. "Will you sing to the baby?" I ask her. Magda smiles. "Of course. Just as I sang to you and your sisters." She squeezes my hand. "I will teach you my songs." That night I don't dream of blood, or Pablo's dead eyes, but of a little girl, her tiny hand clutched in mine, her long hair flowing behind me. I brush her hair until it gleams, braiding it. and she asks me to tell her stories of Cuba, of my family. She listens intently as I give her our history, as I kiss the top of her head. She is content to sit with me, until I wake the next morning, the overwhelming sense of loss surprising me when I find her gone. I'm not sure how I know, but I do. She needs me, desperately. Perhaps it was the bath, or simply the product of a good night's sleep, but I climb out of bed feeling better than I have in a long time. I dress quickly, making my way to the dining room. One of the maids is listening to Fidel on the radio in her room. It's jarring to hear his voice from the back of the house. The sensation that he has invaded our sanctuary inescapable. I've had enough of his stupid speeches. Enough of Fidel and his promises that will never come true. Empty words from another king of Cuba, replacing one tyranny with another. I want to tell her to turn it off. But in this climate, no one can afford the luxury of shutting one's doors to Fidel. He is in all our homes now, whether we want him here or not. Pablo's dreams of reinstating the 1940 Constitution are just that. Dreams. Instead, Fidel gives us the fundamental law, if it can even be called that. Under this farcical piece of legislation, Fidel has the power to hold prisoners without charge. But this threat pales in comparison to the macabre spectacle at the stadium. How do they not see? The same people who cheer Fidel's cruelty vilified Batista for his. Is it only accepted because they hate us? Because they coveted our way of life? How long do they think Fidel will continue to operate as a piece of fiction, a benevolent Robin Hood? He steals from the rich and gives to the poor. But what will happen when all the money has been driven from Havana? Will he stop? Or will he continue to take and take? Serving in the military under Batista can get you executed. Supporting Batista in a climate where supporting Batista wasn't an option can get you executed. What else will Fidel use as an excuse to eviscerate his opponents? My sisters are sitting at the dining room table from Paris, eating silently when I enter. Where is Beatriz? I ask, noticing her seat is empty. Isabel's brow furrows. I don't know. She was already gone when I woke up. Are you feeling better? Does she suspect? I am, thank you. I stare at the ring on her finger, watching the diamond catch the light, thinking of the ring hidden in my room, the one I wish I had the courage to wear. I want to tell them. I want to tell them, but I am a coward, and I fear in their eyes a traitor. I'm afraid I will break their hearts. I'm afraid they will cast me out for betraying our family. I'm afraid. Pablo died for the very forces that are now destroying our country, the people who threw my father in prison, who beat him, who treated him worse than one would an animal, who very well might come back and kill him. Men who kill for blood sport and entertainment. How do I tell them that? Isabel! Elisa! Beatriz! Magda runs into the room, her eyes swimming with tears, her voice shaking. Ice fills my veins as I look at her, as her face falls before me, as her body simply crumples to the ground. Isabel reaches her first, grasping her arms, holding her up. What's wrong? What's happened? A low, keening sound erupts from Magda, and my world simply shatters. Not Beatriz. I can't lose my sister, too. Where's Beatriz? I ask, my voice calm compared to the terror racking my limbs. Perhaps some part of me has simply become inured to the violence. Did Beatriz return to La Cabaña? Is she in prison now, too? Magda takes a deep breath, her body quaking. She's outside. She found him. A sob escapes her lips. Now Isabel is the calm one. Who? I don't wait for her answer, my legs carrying me out the door, running to the front gates. I kick up gravel beneath my shoes once I reach the path in the front entrance. A crowd is beginning to form in front of the house. Gardeners, staff, someone calls my name behind me, but all I can think of is Beatrice. My steps slow. She's sitting on the gravel floor. Her gown, one we bought together not too long ago when our world was a simpler place, pooling around her. If not for the incongruous setting, she'd look like a debutante posing for a society photo. If not for the blood splattering her dress, staining her palms, or the body cradled in her lap. I know the moment she looks at me. How could I not? I sink to the ground beside her, my legs rubber. I know I'm crying because my cheeks are wet, but I feel removed from my body, as though I've left it and floated up to the sky, looking down on all of us, praying for our souls. They dumped him, Beatrice babbles. I reach out and grasp her free hand. In front of the gate, a car, it sped by and then it stopped. Tears stream down her face. The door opened and I saw him. He's so skinny, isn't he? Like he hasn't been eating for a while. Her fingers shake as she strokes the face that looks so very much like hers. He was already dead when he hit the ground. I tried. I focus on her, because I can't look down. Can't look at him. The crowd around us grows. The servants shrieking. Isabel and Magda crying. Our parents should not see this. Maria cannot see this. Beatrice's gaze meets mine, the wet sheen there covering steel. One day they will pay, she vows. Yes, they will. I look down into my dead brother's eyes.
Chapter 26 Marisol. When they remove the hood from my head, I'm in a room. Gray, nondescript, vaguely residential in nature. There are two armchairs, a table in the corner with a lamp, the light casting a yellow glow around the room. A lumpy couch shoved into another corner. A frayed rug covers a dirty ground. My hands are unbound. The man who grabbed me off the street stands before me, and I open my mouth to plead for my safety. To ask about Luis, a million words and protestations pushing to escape. Before I can cobble together my jumbled thoughts, before I can make myself move, he is gone. Shutting the door behind him with a firm thud, and I am alone. Are they going to question me? Rape me? Kill me? How long are they planning to hold me here? Will anyone realize what happened to me? A tear trickles down my face, then another. The door opens. Another man walks into the room, this one much older. His steps slow. An elegant cane in one hand, wearing a neatly pressed guayabera and crisp trousers. His black leather shoes gleam. Whereas the first man screamed danger, this man screams power. The door shuts behind him with an ominous thud. For a moment we stare at each other, sizing each other up. He's tall and lean, distinguished, his hair a steely gray, his face defined by thin lines and wrinkles, his eyes dark, his gaze hooded. He takes a step forward. We're not going to hurt you, he says in Spanish after a moment, his tone surprisingly gentle for someone who exudes such influence. As though he is the sort of man positioned to send another to his death with the stroke of a pen. I almost believe him, and then I catch myself. Is that part of their game? Lulling their enemies into complacency, and then attacking? And the man I was with, are you going to hurt him? Are they hiding Luis somewhere here too? In another room? I'm not. But I'm afraid I cannot speak to Mr. Rodriguez's whereabouts. My stomach sinks as Luis's last name falls from his lips. This was the threat Luis warned me about from the beginning. Was roughing him up on the street the other night a precursor to this? Will I leave this room alive? Can't? Or won't? I ask, a tremor in my voice. Can't. He speaks with the care of a man who parses each and every word, and for some reason his gentle tone strikes a chord of terror deep within me, the kindness in his voice incongruous with the evening's events. What is his role in all of this? I struggle for calm, reaching for the courage I hope lies somewhere inside me. Then why am I here? What do you want with me? He doesn't answer, but instead walks toward an empty chair in the corner, dragging it in front of me. He takes a seat, crossing his ankle over his opposite knee, in a pose that tugs at my memory. He looks down at my hand, his gaze settling on the ring there. My fingers curl into a protective ball, my knuckles resting on my thigh.
Marisol Ferreira.
A chill slides down my spine as my name falls from his lips. So it's not just Luis on their radar. Do they think I've been involved with his blogging? That I'm helping him? One of the people posting his blogs overseas? Or is this because I've been going around the country asking questions? The man's gaze moves from the ring to my face and back to the ring again.
Were you hurt? I told them to be gentle with you.
Are all Cuban kidnappers this polite? Somehow I doubt it. Still, his words resonate. Told, not asked. Yeah, he's the one in charge. You grabbed me off the street. What did you think would happen? What looks startlingly like regret flickers in his dark brown eyes.
I know. And for that I apologize. I didn't know what else to do.
Why? What do you want with me? I ask again as Luis's earlier words come back to me now. Have I been followed the entire time I've been in Cuba?
You have caught the government's attention. They were already watching Mr. Rodriguez thanks to his extracurricular activities. And then you came to Cuba as a journalist. Your family is known here, on the government's radar, known for supporting efforts against the regime in the United States. Once you arrived in the airport, they were made aware of it.
They? And you? Are you not part of the government? He inclines his head in a subtle nod, acknowledging my point.
Not as much as I was in my younger years, but I still have a few connections. Your presence here was brought to my attention as well.
Why? How am I going to get out of this? These people don't play by any rules I'm familiar with, and even for someone with a last name that normally draws attention, this is an entirely different and far more terrifying microscope to be under.
You've been watching me? He almost looks embarrassed. I've been trying to protect you. When I saw your name, I asked some of my men to look after you, to make sure no harm came to you while you were in Havana. My reach did not, could not, extend to Mr. Rodriguez. His name had already made it up the ranks.
How far up? What does the hierarchy even resemble in a country such as this? Why were you interested in me? Did you know my family before they left Cuba?
He's too young to be a contemporary of my great-grandparents. A bit older than my great-aunts, my grandmother.
His hand shakes as he shoves it in his pocket. And something about that motion, his posture in that chair, the casual elegance of it, is so familiar. When he speaks again, his voice is strained. The emotion there answering the question in my mind.
You look like her.
The final puzzle piece slides into place as a lump forms in my throat.
Of course.
I see traces of my father in him. The eyes, the mannerisms, the build.
Yes, I do.
I take a deep breath. You're the man from the letters, aren't you? My grandmother loved you. You loved her. A look of surprise flashes across his face, and he nods. The evening's events crash over me again and again, and it takes a moment for me to gather my thoughts, to deal with this new twist. This trip to Cuba throws me more and more off balance with each day that passes. I've gone through emotional whiplash. My grandmother loved a revolutionary once. The man I spent my whole life thinking was my grandfather isn't my biological grandfather after all. My biological grandfather is a revolutionary, one of Fidel's men. And now he's alive and sitting across from me. Does he know the rest of it? Does he know my grandmother was pregnant?
Does he know he's my grandfather? I didn't know your name. The letters were unsigned. I thought you were dead, but I've been looking for you.
My name is Pablo Garcia, he replies.
My grandfather's name is Pablo Garcia. Such a simple thing. But suddenly it feels like everything. Why me? I repeat, my tone softer as I study the man I now know as my grandfather.
Because I failed Elisa once, and I couldn't fail her again, he answers.
I've waited and wondered if I would hear something about your family over the years. I've kept an eye on Ana Rodriguez and Magda Villarreal, because they were important to your grandmother. Like I said before, when you came into the country, your name was flagged. I still have friends in the government, and they brought it to my attention. How could I not watch over Elisa's granddaughter? I apologize for the circumstances of our meeting. I never intended to disturb your trip here, only to make sure you were safe. But when I saw the police were planning to grab Luis, there was no other option. I didn't want them to take you. The best I could do was arrange for my men to intervene.
Do you know where Luis is? I ask again.
He's alive. They're merely questioning him for now. If something happens to him, I will know.
What can I do for him?
At the moment?
Nothing.
I am doing everything I can. But these things take time. You getting involved will only complicate things for Luis. If they suspect him of espionage, of colluding with an American... Pablo clears his throat. Perhaps while we wait, we can get to know each other a bit. If you would permit me, I would like to know more about you, about your grandmother. A moment passes while I study him, searching for some sign, a flash of intuition that tells me he is a good man.
You're asking me to trust you.
Yes.
I don't even know you, I protest. All I know is that my grandmother loved you decades ago.
And the letters. Is that enough to go on?
I know. Please give me a chance.
Isn't this what I wanted all along? He looks up to the ceiling for a moment, and when he glances back to me, his eyes swim with emotion.
How is she?
Your grandmother.
Elisa.
I say the words quickly, like ripping off a bandage, for his benefit and perhaps a bit for my own. She passed away 6 months ago. His eyes close for a moment. When they open, there's a wet sheen there.
I'm sorry to hear that.
What happened? Was she sick? He asks the question with the resigned tone of someone who has already watched loved ones succumb to a variety of illnesses, and with an earnestness that tugs at my heart.
No. It was sudden.
They say she didn't feel anything. That she went quickly and painlessly, a heart attack in the night. Her longtime housekeeper found her in bed the next morning.
At least she was spared pain, he says.
He coughs, his hand on his chest, his fingers curled into a fist over his heart.
Why did you come to Cuba?
When my grandmother died, she left a note behind asking to be cremated and to have her ashes spread in Cuba. She always wanted to come back here after Castro.
I'm afraid to finish the sentence.
Not sure if I'm speaking to the man my grandmother loved, or Fidel's loyal follower.
That is a sentiment shared by many in Miami, I'm sure,
Pablo comments, his tone dry.
Did he know my grandmother lived in Miami, or was that merely an accurate guess?
He's had eyes on me since I landed in Havana.
What else does he know about me?
How did he know her married name?
And you decided to stay with Ana?
He asks.
I nod.
Elisa spoke of her often, Pablo continues.
We never met, but I felt like I knew her through Elisa's stories.
She loved Ana very much.
The combination of your last name with Ana's name and address was enough for me to know you were Elisa's.
But how did you know who I am?
Ana mentioned my grandmother had buried a box in the backyard of her parents' house.
I found your letters.
The ring.
His gaze darts to my hand, lingering there. Ana gave me pieces of the story. Then she told me about my grandmother's nanny, and Magda filled in more.
But I don't understand.
Magda told me you died in the Battle of Santa Clara on New Year's Eve.
My grandmother never spoke of any of this to me, I add.
We were close. She raised me. I would like to know this part of her.
I'm trying to fill in the rest of it. Trying to understand what happened. Magda said your friend Guillermo told my grandmother you died. I almost did.